Again, you know we've made a commitment to bring you quality and ways to make your life better. The theme today, of course, as we often do, is how to get things done and for people that are busy and stressed and they don't want to take a lot of time. They want to have something that when they use it in their life, they can call in and they can say to us,
"That was easy."
Yes, we're going for something that's really easy. Well, today our guest, I mean, if you've ever, and many of us have, used many different techniques to help get our potential more activated, deal with issues of the past, so many things, open up some of the pathways in the mind, there's just all kinds of things that have been done and studied. Well, our guest today, get ready for a big treat, Dr. Stephen Larson, who we had on some months ago, had written a wonderful book back then that we talked about, and it was great to talk with him about his book, The Fundamentalist Mind. Well, in the meantime, you can't hold this guy back. He's got another book with some amazing things in it. Just to kind of refresh your memory, and for those who have now tuning in anew, Dr. Stephen Larson, he's studied for many years. He's a graduate of Columbia University, went on to the Union Graduate School to get a PhD, a psychology professor emeritus at the SUNY of Ulster, New York, ran a biofeedback laboratory that serves students and staff for 28 years. I mean, if you've heard of biofeedback, and we'll get a little bit of an explanation, he's got an extensive background. Trained in-depth in clinical psychotherapy with Edward Wilmont, a medical doctor and training analyst at the C.G. Jung Institute of New York. I mean, just on and on. This gentleman spent, if you've watched PBS, Public Broadcast, Joseph Campbell, and all his work with myth. He studied for 20 years. With this man, Joseph Campbell, we're talking about an amazing depth and breadth of study. And what we get to do is hear about some of what he has done with a special place called the Stone Mountain Institute and Stone Mountain Counseling Center. It's an amazing, amazing place. So get ready. We're going to have some fun and adventures as we bring in Dr. Larson. Hello, Dr. Larson.
Hi there, Ken. Can you hear my voice clearly?
I can. And is that mutual?
Yeah, you sound a little fuzzy, but I'm right next to the phone there, so I can hear, I can make out everything you're saying.
Okay. Well, that's good. We want to be able to do that. Now, I made mention of that you have an extensive background in biofeedback, and I'm just wondering, would you briefly give our listeners an overview of biofeedback?
Well, biofeedback, probably the first person, many people don't know this, one of the first people to use biofeedback in the 20th century was Carl Jung. He began a series of experiments. He was a psychiatrist at the Berghotsli mental hospital in Zurich, Switzerland, and he had access to a captive population of patients there. In fact, he did more. You know, Freud and Jung had a friendship. Freud is about 19 years older, Jung 19 years younger, and Jung has gotten a reputation as a mystic. Freud is the great scientist, but actually Jung was the first one who did experiments, and he was one of the early people to make use of the GSR, or classic lie detector, which measures skin conductivity. And when a person is lying, that variable is likely to change. Modern polygraphs use many other things, but that was an early thing. And Jung noticed when he gave a series of stimulus words to patients, and he had a stopwatch and he had a skin galvanometer on them, that they would respond with a fair amount of alacrity, you know, maybe a tenth of a second or half a second or something like that to his questions. And the GSR was relatively even. And then he would come to a really tricky word or memory or concept for the person, like maybe say their mother. And suddenly the GSR would start registering, and they'd have a long time replying, and then Jung would say, aha, now we will talk about your mother. So he used it as a diagnostic tool to locate what he called complexes in the personality. Now, complexes are, let's say, sort of imagine an onion in the psyche, if you can for just a moment, stretch a metaphor a little bit, and it has many layers, and it's all based on a core issue that is a problem for you. For some people, it's like an inferiority complex. That's the most famous kind, but you might have a mother complex or a father complex or an authority complex, et cetera, et cetera. These are issues and topics, and probably laced in there are, you know, memories in your life, including your traumatic history, that then could be elicited by psychotherapy. And psychotherapy was absolutely outrageous when Freud was first using it in the last part of the 19th century. People called it Dr. Freud's talking cure, and the idea that you could affect anything by talking to people was astonishing. But Jung came along with his GSR and his controlled studies and published studies, and he brought them to Freud, and he said, look, I have just proved your theory of the unconscious, and Freud liked that idea.
Ah.
And so they became friends, and the friendship lasted for about, 7-8 years, something like that. Both traveled to the United States together. But back to your question about biofeedback, and you did mention, Ken, in your nice introduction, that I ran a biofeedback lab for actually 25 years at SUNY Ulster. I probably ran 10,000 students through that program in one form or another, and I had a special program called the Psychology of Consciousness. Not too many colleges or universities in the country have such a thing, but I'm more a follower of William James than I am of Ivan Pavlov, and I like James's approach to studying what consciousness feels like from the inside. Our biofeedback devices, we learned, could really accelerate the process of introspection, going inside yourself. Something like an EMG would tell you how tense or relaxed your muscles were. And you could say, well, don't I know that already? And the answer is, you might be distracted, you might not know that already. So the little robot, as I call it, doesn't lie. The little robot says, you're pretty tense.
Uh-huh.
And then when you really get that, then you begin to relax automatically. It's not really a voluntary thing necessarily. It's a kind of that's the feedback loop, and it's, you might say, it's nature regulating itself.
Wow, just being aware of it can be helpful to release some of the tension.
awareness is an enormously is the most powerful, exquisite, versatile tool we have in our armamentarium. Nothing else substitutes for it. And what psychologists call metacognition, the ability to look at your own way of thinking and processing information about the world. And then you can say, gosh, I must be having a lousy day. I'm really pessimistic today. That's genius. That's metacognition. That's where we rise above the morass of our ordinary daily thinking, if you will, which is often mechanical or reactive, and you get a glimpse that something, you know, something amazing is happening. You're standing on a kind of a lofty mountaintop over your experience. If you haven't had that experience, it's you don't believe in it, but meditators and other people who've studied spiritual discipline have to get this stuff.
Ah, okay.
And I think people from all walks of life, cultural creatives and other people, have to be able to critique their own thoughts, responses, beliefs. And if they can't, it's really too bad. And then instead they might use, you know, Freud's repression or self-justification or rationalization or other kinds of, devices, compensatory devices that people use very often. And that's the business of the psychotherapist, of course, is to ferret out those complexes and those problem areas that a person has and help them with them. And then you don't feel like you're stepping on a minefield in your own psyche.
Yeah, it's just kind of like, as people will say sometimes in conversations, something will come up, a topic will come up, and then someone will say to them, "Oh, wait, don't go there."
Yeah, sure. That means that they're doing metacognition. They're rising with the person who is making the statement. They're kind of joining that consciousness and seeing down the pike where that person is going and not liking it, or thinking it's a waste of time or something.
So now
the kind of biofeedback that I specialized in is called EEG biofeedback or neurofeedback, N-E-U-R-O, neurofeedback.
Yes.
And it involves the brain. Now, this is really scary to conventional science because the brain is a peculiar organ in the human body that only is aware of itself through its thoughts. It doesn't have sensory neurons on itself. So headaches are not anything from your brain, or I shouldn't say they're not anything from your brain, they're related to it, but it's not your brain that's hurting, it's your scalp and the vasculature that's in your head and the musculature and that kind of stuff. So the brain waves seem mysterious. Many, many of my colleagues in both psychology, neuropsychology, neuropsychiatry, neurology, are very, very skeptical, for example, that particular brainwave ranges or speeds refer to states of consciousness. They say, oh, that's hogwash, that's nonsense. Well, any neurofeedback clinician who's done a half an hour of training in a competent lab knows exactly that your states of consciousness are sort of discernible in mathematical formulae, and computers can kind of interpret these things. For example, on my biofeedback equipment for EEG at the college, I had a cute little device so that students could theta train. Now, all the different brainwave ranges carry Greek letters. This goes back to when brainwaves were first discovered in the mid-1920s by a German physician named Hans Berger. And Berger called the first brain waves he found alpha. And they were all over the brain. They're the most numerous kinds of brain waves. And they center at about 10 hertz. They vary from 8 to 12, more or less. And then below that is theta, let's say 4 to 8. So this device that we had on our biofeedback equipment would allow students to train down in theta. Now, theta is kind of cool, because that's where the gateway to the unconscious opens up, and suddenly you can find yourself in the presence of hypnagogic images, or people would have suddenly like religious experiences, or memories of early childhood, or it was not infrequent for me to come in and find tears running down somebody's face as they sat there impassively hooked up to this machine, And I would go, oh, some theta training. Very nice. Keep going. the little device then would, as soon as they actually slipped below 4 hertz, they were in the region, the deep, slow region we call delta. That means that they were asleep. So a little alarm would go off. And so there's a proof that your brain waves are clearly connected to states of consciousness. In fact, one particular frequency, about 4 hertz, makes the difference between unconsciousness and consciousness.
Ah.
So when you're asleep at night, it would be nice if you had some nice, fat, fluffy delta going through.
Yeah.
Most of your, about 70-80% of your sleep will be like that. And then there are stages of sleep. There's an architecture of sleep. And then at the top of that, you have the REM cycle, which is close to waking consciousness and physiology. And that's when you begin to dream, remembering the dreams or not. And dreams, of course, have only been connected with rapid eye movement and certain brainwave ranges since about, let's see, I think REM was discovered about 54 years ago. But when they have an EEG on people, they can tell when they're dreaming. They can see the delta waves suddenly yield to something like alpha or beta, which is usually associated with waking consciousness. And even you'll see a person's eyes moving back and forth behind their closed lids. That's what REM or rapid eye movement means. And you wake the person up and say, were you dreaming? And they go, oh, yeah, I was at a ping pong match. So the phenomenology, the content of the dreamer's experience corresponds to what you saw in the EEG, corresponds to other physiological signs that you can read, like an elevated pulse rate and various kinds of EMG changes and respiration changes. All that would go along with it, and the person is activated during a dream. Sometimes when people are fighting in a dream, for example, their heartbeats go up as if they were actually fighting.
Wow.
But anyway, back to the theme of these different kinds of brainwave ranges. Alpha, right in the middle of the gear shift, if you will, it's sort of like neutral on the stick shift, if you will. And it means that the brain is kind of idling a little bit. It's not necessarily doing anything. 8 to 12 hertz. Then as you slide up, you have an alpha-like wave called SMR, or sensory motor rhythm. It's first really identified both experimentally and clinically in the 1970s and 80s by Dr. Barry Sturman of, I think at that time he was at the Sepulveda Veterans Hospital. And he discovered that this next brainwave range up from alpha was the same brainwave that cats had when they were waiting outside a mouse hole. Now, the cat is producing this nice sensory motor rhythm right over the strip called the sensory motor strip, right behind the Rolandic fissure there, in the sort of the middle to the back of the brain. And the animal is not moving. Just the tip of his tail is twitching, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then when poor Mr. Rodent emerges from the hole, glom. Got him. There's no pause. So Sturman began thinking, holy cow, this is really interesting. And he found that it was actually, when they tried deliberately to give those cats seizures, they were resistant to seizures. So he had discovered, in EEG terms, the first anti-seizure or anti-epileptic protocol. If you could train, and it was astonishing to actually train human volunteers, which then worked, and these were pretty darn good controlled studies, and they were published, and they made Barry very famous. They were an idea that you could control seizure-like activity in the brain by a learning technique, not inserting anything alien or toxic into the brain, not you know, hitting it with a big chemical barrage or hitting it with the kind of thing they use in ECT where they try to actually shoot high voltage through your brain and induce a seizure. Like it's called electroconvulsive therapy. And some people swear by it as a cure for depression. But I think it's kind of hard on your memory.
I wouldn't be surprised.
It's a massive kind of, in some ways, medieval procedure. Some people love it. I'm not a fan of it. But imagine the idea that you could train an epileptic child, as Sturman is shown doing in a BBC film, who has, you know, 50 seizures a day, to reduce that to 5 or 10 because he's concentrating. And then a colleague, Joel Lubar, said, ah, I wonder what would happen if we taught that SMR training to attention deficit students or ADHD students, because their problem in the classroom is that they're always buzzing around and making a ruckus and poking other people because they're in a search for stimulation. Their brains are running kind of slow. And that's why they're disruptive behaviorally, and that's why something like stimulants or Ritalin actually works for ADD kids. You think ADHD kids, hyperactive attention deficit kids, why give them speed? Their brains are running slow. That's what makes them restless. And so you give them speed, and they suddenly have a higher brainwave range called beta. That's up 15, up to about 28, the various ranges of beta cycles per second. And these are associated with first mental effort, problem solving, thinking. You're probably in a beta state as you sit down to try to do your income tax return.
Okay.
You're thinking about a lot of things. And what happens after you work on that income tax return, as my poor exhausted friend Wendy Jane does when she had an all-nighter working on her income taxes? What happens?
Yeah.
A profound fatigue.
Yeah.
And because that beta, the brain uses, I think, about a quarter to a third of the body's glucose and oxygen and everything. The brain is a real furnace up there. And you're exhausted. So when your brain is really lit up and you're thinking and you're actively working, boy, you're burning that energy. And yet what you have to do with people, some people get into very, very high beta, 22 to 28 cycles per second, 28 hertz, and that's very often associated with anxiety syndromes and hypervigilance. And we will find those brain waves in the brains of people, let's say, who saw the trade towers come down, or people who were in Iraq or Afghanistan in the military forces. You'll see that stuff because the brain freaks out when it sees things it can't wrap itself around. That is to say, you know, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, means that you you're overwhelmed by something, and your brain has to throw up defenses, or you feel like you're going crazy. Now, I did deviate from my previous topic. A seizure, I should also explain. A seizure is brain waves getting out of control, and suddenly the brain waves all over the brain are doing the same thing at the same time, and that affects the motor areas, and that's why the person has a grand mal seizure. They lose control and they fall down and start twitching around, and it's very scary. That's a grand mal type of epilepsy. But they then give anticonvulsant drugs, which are drugs that have a kind of an inhibitory effect on the kindling of the brain. And those are drugs that are very commonly used these days, not only for calming down seizures, but they're used off-label for controlling bipolar disorders and all kinds of mood instabilities. Psychiatrists and pharmaceutical companies will often find themselves using drugs that haven't been tested for those particular disorders, but in clinical practice they work. And that's what, you know, that's the biggest criticism of biofeedback or neurofeedback. Oh, there isn't enough scientific evidence or experiment. There's tons of it, actually, if for people whose minds are open to it. And Most of the evidence is clinical. There's some pretty darn good controlled experiments, but and peer review. There's certainly peer-reviewed journals, and there are double-blind placebo-controlled studies. They're not huge literature, but they're substantial. You know, we know that people can change their brainwave ranges. Suppose you had one of those people. You might remember this from The Fundamentalist Mind, Ken. I told the story of this young woman. I have her hooked up to an EEG, and I know her to be a very, very bright young woman. Her ex-husband was paying for her neurofeedback because he was so guilty about the marriage breaking up. He wanted her to feel good and be mentally healthy while raising their child, and she was. She was an enormously mentally healthy person, but as I was mapping her, I found this unbelievable hot spot of high beta in one of her hemispheres, and I just had to stop her, and I said, gee, this is funny. I don't think I saw this when I last mapped you, and I'm just looking at checking my electrodes and all that, but they were okay. And I said, can you think of anything that really disturbed you? And all of a sudden, she started to cry convulsively, and she talked about a news report that she had just gotten about Iraqi soldiers shooting 10-year-old boys in the streets. And she has a 10-year-old son. And she just had a huge convulsion right there in the therapy chair. And this is what Dr. Jung was doing back in 1900. He was using a little robot, a little device, on the skin of a person to give us an extra information signal about the fact that that person was getting into some pretty deep emotional stuff. And the EEG can certainly do that, too. For example, some of the Vietnam vets I've treated, just as we're giving them the brain stimulation, they'll convulse in the chair, or they'll scream out loud, or they'll go duck and go mortar attack or something like that. They literally, these things are stored in the brain. Now, I did say a little bit about post-traumatic stress disorder, so I should add something to that. Post-traumatic stress disorder, people have seen something so horrible they can't wrap their minds around it, something horrendous, the Trade Towers coming down, people dying, falling to their deaths, and all this kind of stuff. You might want them to kind of slow down a little bit, get into that alpha and theta. You have to be careful now. You have to be very, very careful with traumatized people going into theta, because that's where the old memories are stored, sort of under lock and key. They build a neurological barricade around those memories. And that's how they keep sane. It's the same kind of thing, by the way, in TBI. And Ken, you may have read about that in the Healing
the
Power...
traumatic brain injury?
Of neurofeedback, yeah, traumatic brain injury. When somebody's had a traumatic brain injury, in the brain's own neuroprotective efforts, it throws blockades around its own functioning. Now, that's not a good thing, because the brain is supposed to be able to talk to itself, so to speak.
Yeah.
All the circuits are open. And it's a bummer if only half the, you know, you can only call from New York to Chicago, but you can't call L.A., right? So half your brain might not be available because you've got a blockade. That's where I talk about neurological splitting. And
now is that where they got the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing?
Well, yes. The bridge between the two cerebral hemispheres is a slender group of myelinated neurons called the corpus callosum. And it's only 300 million neurons. Now, that sounds like beaucoup, but...
Well, if you have to count them one at a time,
Well, if you think that there are 5 billion on either side, that's a lot.
Yeah.
So these guys all might be trying to communicate through that slender bridge, and even if your brain has been rattled back and forth in a low velocity accident, the fossae, the bony spurs on the inside of your brain will give you an abrasive effect on the brain itself. The brain is really a gelatinous mass that's kind of sloshing around in there, and it's very, very susceptible to whiplash injuries and contra coup, which means that the brain kind of rattles. You get a blow on one side and the brain bounces off the other side, but that's where it's really, really injured. So when somebody's got a traumatic brain injury or has had a psychological trauma, the brain, it's similar to the way the brain reacts. Namely, it builds a wall around the thing.
Ah.
And that is why when you do recover traumatic memories, they are very often eidetic memories. That means photographic memories where you actually see, feel, hear, smell, and sometimes have powerful emotional reactions to all of the above.
Just like it was going on.
Something that happened in your childhood.
Yeah.
Or something that happened 10 years ago in the war. And I've had people relive the expression on the face of a Viet Cong soldier that he shot between the eyes. The guy just jumped up next to his tank, and he had not a moment to think. And this is why I'm a bit of a pacifist myself. It's not only that war traumatizes people and that they get head injuries and they get legs blown off and, you know, all kinds of things like Bob Woodward's injury, a journalist in Iraq, but they do horrible things to people, and those have very, very complex ramifications.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the worst post-war trauma that I've worked with are officers who made decisions that killed 20 men. Now, that's, talk about trauma. Now, they can still remember a lot of the incidents, but there's a place where they sit like on a powder keg of emotions.
Mm. So, yeah, because to do things, if I'm understanding, to go to war, you have to basically dehumanize the other person. So, but yet somewhere inside you go, wait, this is a human being.
Well, to do these cruel things that soldiers and warriors are trained to do, you have to dissociate the tender part of yourself, the compassionate part of yourself, and just wall that thing off and then do your dirty deeds. But what about 3 weeks later when that other part comes back?
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things that to me was so exciting is I'm reading through your book, and I want to, you know, invite my listeners, please go visit StoneMountainCenter.com, StoneMountainCenter.com, because this is where you can learn more about the work of Dr. Larson, and can you get the book also there, The Healing Power of Neurofeedback, or Amazon? Where can we get this book?
You know, we do carry it in our office, Ken, but we just refer people to Amazon. They're sort of friends of ours, if you will. And they carry it, and they can probably sell it to you cheaper than I can. And the book is in print, and I think Barnes & Noble carries it as well. It's just out in 1996. So I wrote The Fundamentalist Mind. As soon as I put that book down, I picked up the other one, and everybody groaned. but I had already agreed to do it, so I finished it.
Okay.
And, the Fundamentalism book was a response to 9/11. I live fairly close to New York City and have an office down there, and it was pretty traumatic, and I wanted to sort of understand what went on in the minds of people who can do this kind of a thing. And those terrorists, those guys on those planes, they entered a very peculiar state to do that. It's called dissociation. It's a little bit like hypnosis. And in order to be able to do that, and to do that to all the living people on the planes, and all the people they didn't know in those towers, you have got to have a split personality. That's a layman's way of saying it. But you dissociate. And then you turn yourself over in an automaton-like way. You seal off your heart. You wall off half of your brain. And you do the deed. And then if you survive the encounter, what about 10 years later? Or 2 years later? And what if you come back to this country without, in the beginning, the American military and the U.S. government were kind of careless about reintegrating vets back into the country. Ken, you mentioned earlier my work with Joseph Campbell, and, you know, my wife and I wrote his authorized biography. Fire in the Mind. The first published work that Joseph Campbell did in 1943 was called Where the Two Came to Their Father, a Navajo War Ceremonial. Jeff King, a Navajo informant, and a woman named Maud Oakes, kind of an ethnographer. And Campbell talked about that so much. That was, I think the Bollingen Foundation published it, because the Navajos had rituals to send their young men off, and many Native Americans, original people, served in the military armed forces and defended this country on behalf of the white men who had subjugated and made their lives and their ancestors' lives pretty miserable. But they fought bravely. The Navajo, where the two came to their father, is a ritual formula for sending a young man off to war and then bringing him back again to live in the society. Whew, what a task.
Yeah.
They knew how to do it, and we think they're primitive, huh?
Wow. Talk about some sophistication.
Well, yeah. Traditional people the world over know that you go into a separate state of mind and consciousness when you engage in violence and kill people, and that you'll carry it the rest of your life unless somebody gives you some really, really skillful help. And I do believe that the neurofeedback does offer that skillful help. We have many of our practitioners now. There are probably 250 lens practitioners in the USA, and I think a few more scattered throughout the European countries and few in Asia, but the lens is one of the few methods that I have seen really put a dent, maybe along with some good psychotherapy, and even things like we send the vets to the Native American sweat lodges, and they sweat and they confess their conscience.
Mm. Wow.
It's very good for them.
Yeah, now you brought up this term lens, and for our listeners that haven't had a chance to get your book yet, to me that's an amazing, having gone through your books, an amazing form of biofeedback equipment that to me I'm so excited, because if I'm understanding this technique correctly, you can help support a person to be able to repattern dysfunctional parts of the brain without extensive therapeutic processes, without having to discuss issues, that it is literally being able to look at brain patterns and then to provide a very minuscule stimulation, versus here, stick your tongue into this light socket, which I guess is more intense. I haven't tried it lately, but...
yeah. Well, the LENS, L-E-N-S, stands for Low Energy Neurofeedback System. But by a curious pun, Dr. Len Oakes of California is the originator. And he was really a genius who spanned the early years of neurofeedback, studied with some of the great people, and he couldn't make up his mind whether he wanted to be the guy, one of the guys who goes low. That means the people who were trying to take you down into the unconscious, the Menninger Foundation, Elmer and Elise Green with theta training. Or the people who wanted to take you high, the people who wanted to cure attention deficit disorder with SMR or beta training, that kind of thing. And then he had a eureka moment when one of those little, light bulbs like they show in the cartoons lit up above his head.
Yes.
And he said, it's not the brainwave. There is, instead of micromanaging the brain, suppose we let it heal it. Suppose we let it change itself. It's like... giving the brain a tool to heal itself. This is literally kind of what we do. So it's not, that you want to take the anxious person and bring them down to a slower brainwave range. You do. But instead of doing it as an operant conditioning or, learning exercise, like training a rat, or speeding up the ADD kid so he's producing beta, you simply give the stimulation, it's a little dose of your own brain waves back, and the thing just kind of calibrates itself. It takes, Len used to claim remarkable success in 3, 4, 5 treatments. Our courses of treatment at Stone Mountain Center are quite a bit longer. I would say usually 10 to 20. And some cases in, you know, chronic cases and neurodegenerative diseases, up to 30, 40 sessions. But we're talking about, you know, Parkinsonism and stuff like that. Now, we don't say that we cure anything. We just make it easier to bear. We help the brain to be like a Tai Chi master, to be flexible, to dance around the obstacles in its own landscape, so to speak.
Yeah, well, to me, having studied with Richard Bandler, who was co-developer of neurolinguistic programming, one of the key things about that is his intention was not to take away. I mean, if someone was having an issue with a particular behavior, it wasn't to stop them from having that behavior. It was to enhance their ability to have more choices, more behavioral flexibility, going on the assumption that if you have more tools to pick from, if you're a mechanic or more tools in the kitchen as a chef, that you'll be able to make better choices and will opt for the best choice possible given the tools that you have to work with.
Brain is very smart. If you give it a chance, and that's why they call it a brain, you give it a chance, it can heal itself. And what we see is over repeated lens applications. Let me see if I can think of a story recently that would illustrate this. Well, I work with several obsessive compulsive disorders, OCDs, and those are, psychotherapists almost have given up on them. And by the way, OCD, obsession means that you have recurring thoughts you can't control, and compulsion means that you have recurring ritualistic behaviors that seem to be hard to control or interrupt. OCD is obsession in thought and the compulsion to act out behaviorally. Well, OCD is pretty darn hard to fix, and psychotherapists just throw up their hands and say, I can't do a thing with this. The thing is, the disorder itself is obsessive. It won't give up. And they use various kinds of medication, Prozac and things like that to help, and something called buprenorphine. But these also have side effects, and people don't always like how they feel when they're on them. I've struggled with some really, really difficult cases recently, and we're up around 25 to 30 sessions. And it's not that we cure the OCD, it's just that the episodes of it get shorter and more manageable. It's like you start to have an idea. It's like, remember what you said before, don't go there?
Yeah.
You become more able to say that to yourself. Whereas before you couldn't do that, or yourself wouldn't listen to yourself saying, don't go there.
Well, one of the things that I'm curious about is, for instance, when I think of, like, let's say a professional football player that is a star receiver, that is absolutely at the peak of their game, and they talk about when they're out there, they going for that football, the pass is thrown, and it's like nothing and no one is going to stop them. And to me, I don't know if that comes close to obsessive compulsive behavior, to where they, you know, are just absolutely, they have to do this. And to me, I was wondering, well, geez, is there actually some situations in which having an obsessive compulsive behavior is to your benefit, like going after a pass in a football game?
Well, the basis, they're a little bit different, I think, Ken. The basis of obsessive compulsive disorder is deep in the cleft in the brain, something called the cingulate gyrus. Dr. Dan Amen has written about this, and then another other part lower down called the caudate nucleus. And there are loops. See, we all have these little, call them neurological servants inside ourselves. One of them says, wash your hands before you eat, and say your prayers, and do this or that. And you've been coached in these things by your family of origin and by your culture and all that kind of thing. And then it's great. You can just turn those things over to automatic, and you don't have to think about them. For example, you bump into somebody, you say, excuse me.
yeah.
Now, that's not quite obsessive-compulsive disorder, but it's an automatism, if you will. It happens automatically. You don't think about it. And in some cases, it doesn't even involve, you know, consciousness. You're just aware that you offended somebody, and you say, whoops, I'm sorry, or excuse me, or something like that. And it's you don't think about it. Likewise, when you go into a church, you just automatically take off your hat or something like that, or you see people crossing themselves and so on. Religions, by the way, as I wrote in The Fundamentalist Mind, make great use of rituals. They realize that the human being is prone to obsessive compulsive disorders, and so, Hail Mary, full of grace, blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Hail Mary, full of grace, smile on us sinners now and in the hour of our death. Amen. Now, so you go on and on and on, repeating the same things over and over again, telling your beads, saying your Pater Nosters, as we all were trained to do if we were raised in those traditions. And the Jewish tradition sometimes, or especially Orthodox, is even just full of rituals, and your whole religion becomes ritualized with these automatisms, and you don't even need consciousness anymore. Now, obsessive-compulsive disorder takes an automatism like counting things, and people can't stop counting. So every time they see a flight of stairs, they go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Yeah.
They can't stop.
Okay.
Or if they see an animal, they have to go and immediately wash their hands as a ritual. You know, maybe their mother once told them that animals were dirty or carried germs or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So.
And does this go deeper than a conditioned Pavlov response?
Well, it is. That's what it is.
Okay.
That's what it is. It's a conditioned response. Now.
Okay, because it makes me curious. There was a movie from many years ago, Clockwork Orange. I don't know if you saw it, but one of the kind of the key things is there was a punishment, and in this one person, they wanted to change him, and they were he loved classical music, and when they were torturing him, they were playing his favorite classical music in the background, which when they were done torturing him, he couldn't stand hearing it anymore.
Yeah, sure. All human beings and animals are subject to that kind of conditioning. I mean, no question about Pavlov and Skinner made great contributions. These studies of conditioning psychology are invaluable, but what I'm worried about is that psychology has gotten stuck there. Useful things have come out of it, operant conditioning and token economies and cognitive behavioral therapy even uses a lot of that.
Yeah. But if I'm understanding correctly, using this lens neurofeedback, this low stimulation, like you, I think at one point in the conversation you mentioned, it was almost like a homeopathic amount of stimulation, very, very tiny.
It's tiny. It's infinitesimal. It's measured in, a billionth of a watt, actually, per square centimeter. 10 to the minus 18 watts per square centimeter.
Now, on your website, does it share a bit about some of the different things that you've treated using this technique?
Well, it sounds improbable, but we did do a 100-person controlled study, and an abbreviated version of that is on the website, or it can also be found in the Journal of Neurotherapy, and I presented that at the ISNR, which is the International Society for Neurofeedback and Research, in 2005 to a full packed audience. And it was done on 100 people that we extracted. We had blinded volunteers preserve the anonymity of the patients, extract them from our files, and they included autistic children, attention deficit, anxiety problems, traumatic brain injury, major depression, bipolar disorders, and just in the random, in a sense you might say we had a microcosm of the way that those problems are distributed in the culture. By the way, the most common mental illness, I think, is anxiety-based disorders and followed by depression. And then, OCD is not that common, and schizophrenia kind of falls behind them a little bit. About 1% of the population will be diagnosed schizophrenic and so on. But we have treated many, many kinds of people. Now, once again, we don't claim to cure these disorders, but we just make life so much simpler for people. Anxiety disorders, panic, often have panic with or without panic attacks. We can very often get rid of the panic attacks, and sometimes we'll do that by a combination of EEG training and then heart math training. I was licensed in heart math about 5 years ago out in California, and that there are specific breathing techniques that cause the heart to have very particular kinds of arrhythmias, respiratory sinus arrhythmias. It's called heart rate variability, and when you can get the heart wave coherent, people are less resistant to anxiety. So a very simple therapeutic regimen might be EEG training followed by 10 minutes of breathing. And after 5 or 6 weeks, people are starting to get it. We have a biofeedback machine that measures how well they're doing their heart math type breathing. And you know, we've probably now helped, in just in the realm of anxiety and panic disorders, 40, 50 people over the years. And depression is a different kind of thing. Now, people say, well, wait a minute, how can one size fit all? And that sounds astonishing, and isn't this guy over the top in terms of, you know, claiming things? But the reality of it is, the beauty of the lens method is that it adapts itself. We map the brain, 21 sites around the brain, and we measure all of those, and then we treat each and every one of those sites during the course of treatment so that we leave, in a sense, no stone unturned. Mm. And we treat them with these tiny, tiny amounts of radio frequencies that absolutely can. But you know about this because you know how the electromagnetic noise in our environments can, in fact, impact our health, right?
Oh, yes.
And those are usually not coherent, right? Or
right.
Or coherent in a bad way?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty chaotic.
But your comfort clock clears the environment from the bad kinds of EMFs, right?
Yes.
But we give out a good kind. Now, here's the amazing thing. My New York office is right below the Empire State Building on 34th Street. And here we are using infinitesimal radio signals, and my patients are sitting 200 yards from the strongest radio broadcasting tower in the East.
Wow.
Empire State Building. And I'm going, could this possibly work? And it works just fine.
So the brain's able to differentiate.
The brain is able to differentiate. The brain is used to picking up all these signals that are just noise for it and don't really pertain to it, and it just kind of rejects them. But when something comes along that has its own vibratory signature, it sneaks under the radar and it gets in there and it does something. And that's how this method works.
Wow.
It's conjectural, but what we do know anatomically is that there is something called magnetite, which is a ferromagnetic material found throughout the brain. And this is influenced by radio waves. And it is particularly found in the pineal gland and in the hippocampus. A lot of memories are formed in the hippocampus. So magnetite is there in your brain. Now, we think what happens is that the magnetite is picking up the brain waves all the time because it's a magnetic, you know, ferromagnetic material, and the brain wave activity is, after all,
functioning itself. Yeah, it's magnetically sensitive.
Yeah. So it's measured in microvolts, millions of volts.
I'm just realizing, I feel like we could talk for a lot more, and we've just about come to the end of our hour here.
Oh, no.
I know, and you're just getting warmed up.
Well, I'm going on a trip, but I'll be back at sort of the end of the month, and it's fun to talk with you about this because you're such a receptive listener and thinker in your own right on the subject.
Well, I'm just excited that what I'd like to do is, there's a person locally, because I think that I'm going to go have an experience with some of this, and then invite you to come back on and talk, and we'll discuss this further you know, and there may be a possibility of some of the people that you've worked with wanting to, you know, to share a little of their experience, because I'm definitely excited and want the word out to get out about this much more.
So, I'm glad you do, and it's a wonderful non-invasive technique, an alternative to the pharmaceutical route that everybody thinks they must go. And I'm not saying that medicine doesn't have its value, but it can't do everything either.
Yes, exactly. Well, I just thank you, Dr. Larson, for taking time to be on the program, and thank my beloved listeners for taking time to listen in and to go visit.
Let go and let God, let myself do.